580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a wonderful show for you with the author of a brand new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America. Mark Lloyd will be our guest. He's a journalist, activist, and a scholar and an author with a provocative new book that traces the history of communication policymaking in the United States and has strong recommendations for where we should go in the future. So join us today on Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. But first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The FCC fudges the numbers with regard to the availability of broadband internet access in America. A newly released report claims that broadband penetration grew some 54% from mid-2005 through June of last year. But the problem with the claim lies in how it's defined. For starters, the FCC defines broadband connectivity as any connection with a speed higher than 200 kilobits per second. Hardly a quick figure, considering it's less than 1/7 the speed of today's DSL or cable modem lines. Secondly, the FCC uses zip codes to measure broadband penetration and classifies an entire zip code area as wired if just one customer is connected there, even if that connection involves something like satellite-delivered broadband service. But the most egregious distortion behind the claim is the FCC's counting of 11 million mobile broadband, aka cell phone subscribers, as evidence of increased service. Never mind that cell phone networks with their proprietary and metered architecture don't even come close to resembling a bona fide broadband internet experience. The real bottom line? It's 2007, and just under 60% of U.S. homes still do not have easy, affordable access to broadband.
The fight to save public funding for public broadcasting begins anew as President Bush's newly proposed budget calls for a 25% cut in money to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting starting this fall. That's more than $114 million, though the Association of Public Television Stations puts the full impact of the president's proposal at $145 million. What's worse, the cuts fall hardest on program acquisition and development services, which typically act as incubators for fresh new public television programming. Meanwhile, Bush's budget contains several proposals to strengthen government surveillance programs, totaling a $227 million increase over the amount being spent during the current fiscal year, and seeks to increase funding for non-military propaganda efforts directed overseas through the Voice of America and its affiliates by $25 million.
With little fanfare, Sony has reached a settlement agreement with the Federal Trade Commission over an investigation into copy protection software embedded in some Sony CDs. A year and a half ago, Sony got into hot water when it came to light that some of its music discs surreptitiously installed software onto Windows-based computers that increased their vulnerability to hacker attacks. Under the FTC settlement, Sony must disclose upfront what sort of copy protection mechanisms reside on its content and give users, quote, a reasonable and effective way, end quote, of uninstalling such software. Those who may have Sony media infected with the potentially dangerous rootkit software are still eligible for a company replacement program through June.
Just how good has merger mania been to the new AT&T? The company closed out 2006 with a 17% rise in profits in the final quarter, a large part of the gain due to its full assimilation of the Cingular Wireless phone network, which in its final quarterly report tripled its profits over the course of a year. Net income at AT&T in the last 3 months of last year nearly hit $2 billion. The financial impacts of the company's acquisition of Bell South have yet to be felt. In the last 10 years, AT&T has acquired 13 companies in its race to reassemble Ma Bell for the broadband era. However, the company is facing problems with its self-proclaimed next-generation broadband service dubbed Project Lightspeed, or U-verse. The technology, which delivers phone data and TV over a combination of fiber optics and plain old telephone wires, has been slow to launch. Technical glitches delayed its rollout to 11 markets last year, while the company's target was 20. And there are significant questions about whether 20th century twisted copper phone lines can really provide the capacity to deliver the vaunted triple play of services, especially with regard to high-definition television.
And the FCC has scheduled the third of its six promised public hearings on media ownership. It'll take place on the morning of Friday, February 23rd in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Chairman Kevin Martin has promised to hold public hearings on media ownership and localism about once every other month for the remainder of the year. If you'd like more information on the hearing in Harrisburg or to file your own public comments in the FCC's ongoing media ownership rules proceeding, visit www.stopbigmedia.com. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Today we have a guest I've been looking forward to for a long time, someone I've known for a long time, Mark Lloyd, an award-winning journalist, a communications attorney, an activist, a scholar and a teacher, currently the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's also taught at Georgetown and MIT. Mark Lloyd has written a brand new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published literally in the past 2 months by University of Illinois Press. Mark Lloyd, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure and honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And this is a book, as I mentioned to you before we went on air, I read it a long time ago when at first you were looking for editorial comments, and then I've read it a couple times since, and I've used it a lot in my own research, in my own writing, a lot of your ideas. Why don't you tell folks what this book, Prologue to a Farce, how would you describe it in a nutshell?
Well, it's both a history lesson and an argument about the state of democracy in America and the importance of communications to the operation of democracy in the United States.
It very much is, and for listeners who get a chance to read this book, it is a sweep going from the founding of the Republic and the Constitution through to the present day and going into the future, chronicling the major changes in communication policy, the policy fights. But what's interesting about the book, Mark, is that it's anything but a wonky book. I mean, it is closely connected to broader political questions at every turn. And what I like about the book especially is that, you periodically sort of take a few pages to sort of update people on what the crucial political, economic, and social trends of the period were and how they related to media.
Well, I think that's very important. I mean, so much of what I learned about media and broadcasting when I was a student at the University of Michigan really didn't place the laws and the development of media policy in the context of the times. And those policies were very much a context of the time, and everything from the antitrust rules aimed at Associated Press to, the rules related to what happened with the satellite industry. I mean, it was all so much a part of the times, and I really wanted to try to place this field that is, I think, so important to our democracy in the setting of politics.
Mark Lloyd, our guest today on Media Matters, author of the brand new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America. Mark Lloyd, you were the founder and executive director of People for Better TV, one of the leading citizen activist groups in the 1990s in the United States, and you've been personally involved for decades now with the battle for media democracy, for policies to encourage a more democratic media system, really one of the giants of the area. But this book is interesting because you go right back to the founders, and I'd like to talk about recent experiences and the recent fights and get your perspectives on those, because you talk about those in the book. But I'd like to first go back to go through sort of chronologically some of the points you make in the book, because I think they're so interesting. A lot of our listeners might not be familiar with them. And the place to start, of course, is why this title? What does this title mean, Prologue to a Farce?
Well, the title comes from a fairly famous quote by James Madison, which said that a popular government without access to popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy. The idea really is to try to examine why it was that the founders, and particularly James Madison, believed that communications was so important. And unlike a few other authors, I mean, I don't place the evidence of that statement, the notion that the founders thought communications was of central importance in the establishment of the First Amendment, but really in the establishment of the post office. And the post office, as you know, was the largest part of the federal government when Tocqueville did his famous tour of America in the 1830s to really see what it was that the founders had created, what a republic was, what a true democracy in that time looked like. And there was nothing like the post office. There was nothing like the post office in Europe. The closest we have to what the post office became was the old, you know, Roman Empire, but the communication in the Roman Empire was one way, roughly from the emperor to the folks in the other outlying communities. The post office really was designed by the founders to allow all the folks in the United States, whether they were citizens or not, to communicate among themselves about issues that were important. And it was larger than the Treasury. It was larger than, there was no Department of Commerce. There was no standing army. It was the largest part of the federal government by far.
What was the relationship of the post office to journalism, to newspapers, to communication? Because, I mean, I think today a lot of people might say, I don't get it. So you can send letters to your friends. What does that have to do with democracy?
Well, there were two important developments in the Post Office Act of 1792, again, pushed by James Madison. One was that, unlike the postal department under Benjamin Franklin, under the old colonial system, the post office went from being a revenue-generating machine, something that was essentially designed to provide financial support to the government, to something that was really service first, something that was designed and put in place to make sure that there was communication to Americans without regard to the costs necessarily. This was an extraordinary development. The government said, no matter how much it's going to cost us, if we get a petition for a post road, you know, out in Arkansas, in a territory, we're going to put a post road out there. The second major development under the Post Office Act of 1792 was the subsidy of newspapers. And newspapers were not the newspapers that we think of them today. Newspapers were partisan rags. They were screeds. They were not at all objective or unbiased or anything like that. They were, to some extent, they were really part and parcel of an individual's or maybe even an early party's political process. But the government subsidized newspapers, and the subsidy was paid for by personal correspondence and by business correspondence.
And what effect did this subsidy have? Which is, I'm going to jump ahead here because I think the effect to tip you off, to tip the listeners off, was absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, the effect really created an educated populace. It created a demand for greater citizenship among white males. White males argued that, unlike their counterparts in other countries, they didn't have to be property because they had information. They had popular information so that they could determine what the best policies were. They argued that they were better educated than any other government in the world. This is part of what Tocqueville argued, sort of talking about the fact that Americans really understood both their issues and how the government should run and politics in general more than any other civilized nation in the world. The effect on democracy was just astounding. It really promoted what became the Jacksonian democracy, popular suffrage, at least among white males, whether they had property or not.
Was there much of a difference, Mark Lloyd, between the northern and southern states, the slaveholding states and the free states, in terms of the development of print culture? Or was it pretty much across the board for white males everywhere?
Well, it was pretty much across the board for white males everywhere.
And actually white women, while they didn't have the franchise, certainly were not illiterate.
Well, that's right. You know, it was The amazing thing about the ability to, and let me also point out, the communication was really between citizens. It was not let the government tell us what they're doing, as George Washington had suggested early on. It really was individuals with their printing presses arguing about policies. It was associations, folks gathering together, suggesting how things ought to run and putting those thoughts in the newspapers. One of the, you know, the greatest strains on the early republic obviously was the issue of slavery, and the abolitionist males carried, particularly at first, north and south, most importantly to the west. There were a lot of problems and challenges regarding this communication, but the fact of the post office, of its extent, and the fact that these newspapers were subsidized just had a tremendous impact on the ability of citizens to gather public information, to share their own knowledge, and to decide, you know, how they wanted their government to run.
So this is policymaking that was very healthy and democratic and in the public interest, by comparison to the rest of the book, where it sort of takes a turn for the worse.
Well, no question. I mean, and it's, again, it's extraordinarily important for the public to understand that this was not accidental, that the central place of newspaper subsidies, of the extension of distribution, was deliberate, that these were policies that the founders put in place. This was not something that they hoped would happen. This was a mechanism of government that they created and let operate the way that they wanted to operate.
Mark Lloyd, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580 coming to you live February 18th, 2007. Mark Lloyd's the author of the brand new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published by University of Illinois Press. Wonderful book that traces the history of policymaking and media in this country from the founding to the present day. Mark Lloyd is not only a scholar, but he's a journalist, an award-winning journalist, and he's also been an activist and a communications lawyer for the past two decades. So he is well-versed in current struggles, which we will talk about, which are included in this book. Many of the issues we talk about often on Media Matters, but it also has a rich historical context, which we're talking about now with the founding period of James Madison. If you have any questions or comments for Mark Lloyd, the phone number here at WILL AM 580, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mark, one last point before we get off the post office is you mentioned the abolitionist. How important was the postal subsidy to the abolitionist movement for their ability to do the political work they were doing?
That was extraordinarily important, particularly in the North and particularly in the West. I mean, they had problems after a period of time during the Jackson administration when they flooded the South, particularly South Carolina, with the abolitionist mail. But the fact that that you had this ability of abolitionist, of church leaders to be able to communicate with others, I mean, the importance of the ability to understand that you are not alone, that it's not just the dozen of you in your community, that it is people in states across the country, even in the South, who think and believe as you do, is, I mean, this is what democracy is about. I mean, it's the ability to be able to reach out to discuss and come to decisions about arguments that you have with the way things are.
One of the really interesting sort of sidebars in the book, you have, I think, an overlooked discussion of how capitalism or the economics of the first 100 years in the United States, or 75 years prior to the Civil War at least, were dramatically different than market capitalism in the United States today. And we have to be careful not to sort of project backwards to 1820 or 1860, thinking that their economy worked the same as ours, or the way people experience the economy is the same as people do today. And one of the really striking passages in the book, Mark, was you took some time to talk about Abraham Lincoln's attitude towards the emerging economic divisions in the country. And that was quite striking. And why did you include that? And tell folks, you know, what you found about Lincoln and why you put it in the book.
Well, Lincoln, as I began to do the research and reread the history and reread Lincoln, he became even more of a hero to me than he was when I was growing up and learning about Lincoln and the law. You know, Lincoln spent time as a U.S. representative studying what it was that the founders did and the condition of the country, spending time in the Library of Congress. His colleagues were wondering what it was that he was doing. And he was trying to get a sense. He was trying to get a picture of what the country was like. One of the things that he argued, that even during his day, that African Americans, Americans held in slavery and those not held in slavery, were actually in a worse state in the 1850s when he was making these arguments than they were back during the time of the Founding Fathers in the 1770s and 1760s. His arguments about this were that the suffrage, the ability to vote and participate among free blacks, had actually been curtailed between his time, the 1840s and 50s, and the time of the founders in the 1760s and 70s. That one of the things that was important to understand, Lincoln argued, was that the vast majority of Americans at his time were free, that they didn't have any obligations to a corporation, that they didn't have, they weren't slaves, nor were they slave owners, nor did they have large factories. They were independent Americans who often lived on family farms or had independent businesses, you know, with families working with them to make a living, and they weren't obligated to serve any particular master or any particular set of interests. They were on their own. This was the country that the founders had hoped would be, and one of the things that Lincoln was concerned about was the fact that the extension of this freedom to not only white males but to African Americans, to even Native Americans and states that we had treaties with was deteriorating by the time that he began to make his famous speeches and his debates with Douglas.
He was quite critical specifically of capitalism as it's developing and the role of concentrated wealth and corporations in really destroying democracy, wasn't he?
He was very much concerned about the power of big business. Even though Lincoln was a corporate lawyer, he was very concerned about the power of business, particularly vis-a-vis the ability to get certain things from government and determine policies. And he really fought and struggled to make sure that there was a proper balance between independent Americans who were not living under the auspices of a corporation or a big business and the power of corporations themselves.
Our guest today, Mark Lloyd, author of the new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published by the University of Illinois Press. It's a terrific tour through communication policy history in the United States, looking at the politics at every turn, going from the founders, James Madison in particular, through to the present day, chronicling crucial developments, crucial fights, with a long discussion of recent developments as well. And the phone number here at WILL AM 580, if you want to call in and speak with Mark Lloyd, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Now, I'm a historian, so I am enthralled with your book, probably more than some of our listeners, so I don't want to dwell. You write so much about the 20th century and recent history here, and so much of value with your own work. But I do want to go through a couple other issues, because they're so important to understanding our present context and where we're at. The telegraph looms large in your narrative, and it looms large in sort of the history of the 19th century in the United States, both for economic and political developments. You know, give up, if you could, just a summary of your analysis of the telegraph in American history and how it came to be developed.
Well, the telegraph was an extraordinarily important force in concentrating communication in one or two different organizations. Those particular organizations were Western Union and then the Associated Press. The wire services were extraordinarily useful to be able to both dominate through contract negotiations and through the speed of being able to deliver news from both around the United States and also news from overseas to the rest of Americans. And it provided a competitive advantage for those organizations that had some association with, again, the wire service. The wire service developed through the ability of the telegraph.
Hence the name.
Exactly. The telegraph was at first initiated under a small grant to Samuel Morse for experimental purposes for a line between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. And they figured out all sorts of problems to solve in that experiment, whether the wire should go underground, whether it should go overground, whether it should be coated with rubber. I mean, just all these things they figured out in this experimental line between Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. But then we had a change in political parties from the Whigs to the Jacksonian Democrats, and the Jacksonian Democrats decided they were not going to continue to subsidize or continue to operate the telegraph service under the post office. There was a battle about this for at least the next 50 years, going back and forth with a lot of very important people in our history that are largely forgotten, who argued that we really ought to make sure that the telegraph is accessible as the post office is to average citizens.
Of course, I mean, to cut to the chase here, Mark Lloyd, it remained a privately held monopoly with hardly any public interest obligations at all, if I'm not mistaken.
It was a privately held monopoly, but heavily subsidized by the federal government. So even though they decided they weren't...
Heads down and tails you lose.
Yes. And so even though the Jacksonian Democrats said, you know, we're not going to continue to run the post office, they then spent, you know, really tens of thousands of dollars, which was a lot of money back then, to extend Western Union's service out to the West. Because the telegraph service was so important in establishing the railroad, it was so important for communication between the territories in the West. It was it was of essential importance. So the federal government, we U.S. taxpayers, subsidized the private companies, even though we decided we weren't going to continue to run it ourselves. Which is it's just sort of silly.
You know, that really lets us jump ahead, if we can, the telegraph and that experience, which is public subsidies of private interest with not getting anything in return or very little in return, really gets us right up to the 20th century into the present day with the way that media policymaking has been done and sort of results we've generally gotten. Isn't that a safe statement?
Oh, that's exactly right. I mean, what I argue is that our communications policies are the federal investment in experimentation and research for almost all of our communication mechanisms, the decision to abandon the federal control over that communication mechanism to private interest, and then the subsidization of that private interest by taxpayer dollars or by certain grants and everything from, you know, patent laws to you name it. Added on to that basic structure, we have very weak and not well-enforced so-called public interest obligations and consumer obligations that, again, are weakly enforced and usually enforced at the behest of corporations against other corporations rather than on behalf of the public interest.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Lloyd, author of the brand-new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published by University of Illinois Press. This is a historical book that goes through to the present era, talking about how communication policies have been made and their singular impact upon the United States politically and socially, and how important they are going forward into the future. And a lot of the book talks about the last few years and where we are currently. So this is not just a history book. If you'd like to call in with a question or a comment, the telephone number here is 333-9455 and our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Mark Lloyd, let's jump ahead if we can now to sort of the era in which you start entering the picture, and I do too, coming of age as a young person in America in the 1960s. Let's talk about some of the big developments that start to take place in the 1960s, and you talk about in the book. One group you talk about that I don't think a lot of Americans, unless they're our age, know about is called the Kerner Commission. And they had a very important report. Could you talk a little bit about the Kerner Commission and why they're in your book?
Well, the mid to late 1960s, this country was faced with riots, it seemed, every summer. In major cities across the country, from Watts to Washington, D.C., to cities in the South, to where I grew up in, which is Detroit, Michigan, we had riots. And the country was sort of concerned about what this meant, and what did the Negro want, and when, what was going on. And President Johnson asked Otto Kerner, governor of Illinois, to lead a commission to investigate the causes of the riots. And one of the things that he asked was to find out what role media had to play in both encouraging the riots or encouraging the police activity. And what the Kerner Commission reported was that the media, largely dominated by whites, were not reporting to the majority of their viewers or listeners or readers the despair, the degradation faced by blacks in cities across the country, and that therefore it was next to impossible to understand that we were really two nations. We were becoming two nations, separate and unequal. And that until the media began to really begin to address the issues facing these different communities, we weren't going to be able to come to a common understanding about our common problems in the United States.
You know, Mark, that reminds me of something I heard Ben Bagdikian say once. Ben Bagdikian, the legendary reporter and editor, was working as a daily newspaper reporter. And in the 1950s, he was able to convince his boss, I forget which newspaper, I think it was in Providence, but he might have moved on by then, to let him cover the burgeoning civil rights movement, which had barely begun. And part of his assignment was to travel around to major northern cities in the United States and talk to the leading daily newspapers there to see what their take was on the situation. And he would go to cities like Detroit, Chicago, and Cleveland, and he talked to the Tribune editor, the Plain Dealer, the Free Press. And he said, let me see all your articles on racism in your community. And the editors would always look at him like he was, stoned. Like, what are you talking about? We don't have any racism in our community. There are no articles. We don't cover that. That's not a beat in Chicago or Detroit or Cleveland. And, Bagdikian's point then, I think backing up with the Kerner Commission found, was this was simply an uncovered story. Leading up, most Americans, if they just read their daily newspapers, they have no idea what was going on.
Oh, that's right. And or if they watched television, they would have no idea what was going on in other communities. I mean, they might actually have had a better idea about what was going on in their own communities within their particular racial enclave, but they would have no idea what was going on across the tracks or in the Black Bottom or in the Spanish Barrio. They would just not know.
I've got a caller I want to get to in a second, Mark Lloyd, but let me just ask you to finish this point to complete the circle. The Kerner Commission critique, is that still a pretty accurate critique in your view of journalism in the United States?
Well, the fact is that we have a much more integrated, if we even use those terms these days, set of newsrooms than we had before, but we're actually going backwards. We're losing the number of minorities in news operations, newspapers, radio stations, television stations across the country. The Kerner Commission, in addition to suggesting very specific hiring and employment policies, they also help to generate a wave of public engagement with media itself. People once again began to understand that media was not just a business, but that they were an important social player in the community that had a role to play in the riots and other things that were going on.
Our guest, Mark Lloyd. This is Media Matters. The phone number here, 333-9455. Toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 1, Champagne, you are on the air.
Thanks. Good afternoon. I'm concerned about the status of the bill which was going to allow Verizon and AT&T to make rules about the charges on the Internet. And I know that, I guess it went through the House, and, of course, in the between time, we've had the Democrats taking over the House and the Senate. But I'm wondering what your take is on the status of the bill, and will the new administration have, the new administration in the House and in the Senate, have the guts to, you know, stomp on that bill and kill it?
Okay, Mark, are you familiar with this bill?
The caller, I had difficulty hearing the caller throughout the question. If you could repeat it.
Caller, could you repeat the bill again?
Yes. It's my understanding that a bill to allow the AT&T Corporation and the Verizon Corporation to essentially control the Internet.
Mm.
Very similar to the way that happened with the telegraph.
Yeah, I get it now. I think we get it now, Carter. Yeah. That's what we need here. And this is an issue, actually, we're very fortunate to have Mark Lloyd here because he is a senior fellow running, really, a lot of the media policy work at the Center for American Progress. And this is the issue of network neutrality, whether the phone companies and cable companies can sort of give some websites privileged access and put others on a dirt path, creating tiers and forcing people basically to pay them extra money if they want to have high-speed access to the public. Mark, what's the status of net neutrality in Congress now?
Well, there are a couple of things going on. One is that there was a recent approved merger between SBC and AT&T. In that approval, AT&T, SBC, agreed to a certain set of conditions where they were promised to treat essentially all the folks who wanted to get on the net equally. This was sort of a concession to net neutrality. The challenge with that agreement is that it's limited to 2 years. There are a number of folks in Congress who are concerned about trying to extend clear net neutrality provisions across the board to apply not only to folks who are trying to merge, but to apply to Verizon and to Comcast and everyone else who provides telecommunications or information services. It's not clear whether or not anything is going to happen, frankly, at least this year. But we at least have Congressman Dingell and Congressman Markey and Senator Inouye who've expressed strong support for net neutrality. And they've also expressed strong support for the continued ability of local communities to have a say about where telecommunication services are laid, are deployed in their communities. And so this is very much a live debate. It's still going on. It's a battle that's not over. It's not won. And your concerns, your efforts, your letters to members of Congress to say we need to be able to save the Internet, we need to preserve and advance principles of net neutrality are extremely important at this time.
Our guest, Mark Lloyd, who you've just been listening to, author of the brand-new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America. We've been talking about that book. Mark Lloyd is also besides being an award-winning broadcast journalist, a communications lawyer, a scholar, he's also the founder of the group People for Better TV, one of the leading activist groups in Washington representing public interest policies in the 1990s. So versed in virtually all the issues we could possibly talk about on the program. Manners, you have to be a permanent guest, Mark. You can, hardly anything I can't throw at you. I do want to talk now, if we can, about public broadcasting. It's a subject that you refer to in the book, and at the end of the book you have some fairly strong recommendations for how you think it should be reformed. But let's talk a little bit about the history. How did public broadcasting develop in the United States, and what sort of factors put it on the path that got us to where we are today with it?
Well, much of what I learned about public broadcasting early years came from reading you, Bob. So it was the old educational broadcasters and their fight for space on the radio dial.
Like WILL in Illinois.
That's exactly right. And educational broadcasters continue to fight. It was a great woman, Frieda Hennig, who was at the FCC, who really had a larger vision for educational broadcasting. And it really was a vision where she saw an alternative to commercial broadcasting. Non-commercial broadcasting, broadcasting that was really driven by a different impulse and set of concerns that were not related to the market, and it was her working with a variety of other people to really begin to push for something that ultimately became public broadcasting. I think she would be very disappointed with what we ended up with. But the notion that we move from educational broadcasting, which was really designed to provide at least instruction from educational institutions out to community groups, to something that was really designed to allow a place for the public to come to have discussions that were not necessarily tainted or controlled by commercial impulses, was really advanced by Lyndon Johnson. It was through Lyndon Johnson's work with people at both the Ford Foundation and his work with folks at the Kearney Commission that ultimately created a Corporation for Public Broadcasting that ended up funding both non-commercial broadcasting, radio and television, but did not do it in a way that that many of us understand that it needs. This Corporation for Public Broadcasting remains still far too influenced by politicians, by the impact of the budget, by a corporate board that's essentially appointed by the president or people who are close to the president. It does not, by and large, serve the public.
In your book, at the end, you have a list of policy remedies or suggestions to really democratize American media, and one of the core areas is public broadcasting. If you were made king of the world for the day, what would you say the way to solve the problem of public broadcasting in the United States is?
Well, there are two important problems that really cannot be divorced from each other with public broadcasting. One, it's a governance structure and the responsibility of local and the national broadcasters to respond to the public, to be able to be responsible to what the public says by vote, by committee meeting, by meetings with local communities. We've got to get the governing structure of public broadcasting right. After that, it has to be fully funded. It has to be funded in a way that is really competitive with all other commercial broadcasters.
How is the funding of public broadcasting in the United States compared to that of Britain or a European country?
Well, it's paltry. I mean, I think the amount of broadcasting, the amount of dollars that the BBC gets, for example, I think it's like almost seven times as much.
It's more than that.
Yeah,
it's
if you include everything, it's just extraordinary the amount of support that the BBC gets as compared to public broadcasting. And again, I think you're right. I'm trying to be very conservative in my estimates.
Could there be popular support, if a politician were to run on that? Do you think that voters would throw tomatoes at that politician, or do you think they would have their support for that?
Oh, I think they'd love it. And when we were doing the work, and again, it was a group of folks who were trying to do this work with People for Better TV.
Now we're going to the late 1990s.
Exactly. So, I mean, folks like Mark Crispin Miller and Janine Jacquet, and there were a number of others who were really joined in this effort. And we did a series of polls, and one of the things we asked was, whether or not you should get the commercial broadcasters to pay some percentage of their profit, and then to put that money and earmark it to support public broadcasting around the country. And the amount of support that we got for that proposal was extraordinary. We had, a solid majority of 70% plus of Americans thinking that was a great idea. There are folks who, for good reasons, who really do believe in public broadcasting as a possibility, but they also understand that it is not well-funded and that they would be, I think, fully in support of some system that decided they were going to earmark some money and take it out of Congress's hands and really support public broadcasting. But again, it's also important to note that it's not just money, that the problem with public broadcasting is not just that they don't have enough money. I mean, they need to be, the public broadcasters must be much more responsible to the local citizens. They must be much more responsible to doing journalism that's important for us. One of my key recommendations regarding public broadcasting is requiring them to cover local city councils, requiring them to cover the state departments or the state houses, and requiring them to cover the federal government and to put resources and money and really cover that stuff, to cover the administrative agencies. And so we've got all these different communication mechanisms. You can find out online what your local member of Congress is doing. Public broadcasting ought to be required to do all that stuff.
Our guest today on Media Matters is Mark Lloyd, author of Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published by University of Illinois Press. Mark Lloyd's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington. He's taught at Georgetown and MIT. He's an award-winning broadcast journalist and a communication lawyer. He's been active in media politics, media activism for a long time, and knows about us much on the subject as anyone I know. We're very fortunate to have him today on the air on Media Matters. If you want to call in, we still have time for another caller. The number 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. One of the interesting discussions in the book that I got a kick out of was this issue of Al Gore inventing the Internet. I think, 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, whenever it was, when Gore was running for president, much was made ridiculing Al Gore for being some sort of pompous blowhard for claiming he could have invented the Internet. But you sort of come to Al Gore's defense in this book. Explain.
Well, I do. So Al Gore gets both a hit from me and he gets a pat. So to be balanced, I should say that I was not happy about the fact that Al Gore sort of backtracked in saying that the Internet was going to be built by private industries. And I wasn't at all happy about that. He sort of
he backtracked from a position before he became vice president.
Yeah, before he was vice president, he said that the Internet ought to be an information superhighway. He said and funded just like we built the federal highway system, and the federal government ought to be involved in that. After he became vice president, he said no, this ought to be built by private industry. Mm-hmm. That was not the right, I don't think, thing to say. What Al Gore did as a senator was extraordinarily important. Not only did he encourage the United States to do a much better job in understanding the impact of greenhouse gases and global warming, for much of his service as a senator from Tennessee, he also encouraged the use of what was then a fairly unknown infrastructure between a few defense-related institutions, allowing their different computers to communicate. And he said, we need to be able to spread this ability out, this new internet communication out to other research institutions to figure out how this can be used and how this can be used by other Americans. And his support for the National Science Foundation was really critical in creating what we now think of as the internet.
You know, Mark Lou, we have a couple callers. I want to get them to make sure we get them both on the air before we have to go off the air. So let's do that right now. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Mark Lloyd.
Yes, good afternoon. Thanks for my call, taking my call here. Wanted to go back to the public broadcasting. On Media Minute, we heard that the new budget is going to, I believe, cut public broadcasting by 25%, if that's what it was. And but at the same time, I wanted to ask, how much money do we spend for Voice of America and all the other broadcast services that we have to send a radio signal to non-nationals, to other people? And I just find it incredible that we're not spending a same amount of money to talk to our own people. And I'll get off and your comment. Thank you.
That's a great question, Spring Bay. In fact, Mark, let me expand on that, not just Voice of America, but also if you add in Armed Forces Radio and Television and Radio Marti and these variety of other surreptitious services. Any idea what the expenses are for those compared to what we spend on public broadcasting?
Well, not off the top of my head, but it's not... it is not as much money as you might think. It's perhaps the last time I looked at this, the amount of money spent on things like Radio Marti and Voice of America and Armed Forces Radio Network was really about a third or so of the amount of money that was spent on public broadcasting. The challenge with it is that it's just sort of a one-way, pretty much, communication mechanism, like setting up a studio. It's not designed for promotion or any of the rest of these things. But it's not very much money. The good point that the caller makes is that clearly the federal government understands the importance of projecting American voice and image abroad and you know, communicating with the troops and everything else. But that what we're missing is the ability of Americans to communicate effectively with each other. So it's not so much what does the U.S. imperial state project, but what are we communicating as a democracy with each other about what's important for us.
Let's go back to the phone lines now to our last caller. Mark, are you familiar with Frina, Illinois? It's a hotbed of listenership for our
program. Oh, really?
And we're going to go to line one now. Frina, you're on the air with Mark Lloyd.
Hi, thanks. The Now program last Friday was about the NSA spying, and if you could comment quickly on that and how, well, just basically I feel Bush should be impeached, among other things, for allowing that. Also, the model of the Pacifica governing board where they took back control, I know you don't have time to talk about all this, but thanks for your show. It's been great.
Well, thank you very much. I didn't have a chance to see the Now program he's referring to, but I'm familiar with the NSA spy scandal. Do you have any comments on that, Mark?
Well, my understanding from black letter law, from clear law, is that the executive branch does not have the power or authority to wiretap any U.S. citizen in this country without a court order. And that's what it was that the Bush administration was doing. I've never seen a clearer violation of law in the United States. I mean, that's, we have checks and balances. That means that, yes, they can spy if they get a court order. But they were doing it without court orders. This is not constitutional. And I think the Bush administration understood that, which is why they've been really quick to work with this Congress to come up with a way to allow them to essentially move beyond what was, I think, a pretty clearly illegal spying effort.
Now, was there a role of the telecommunications company, a relationship they had with the Bush administration here that we should be concerned about?
Well, I think the concern concern is that the telecommunications companies, Verizon, AT&T, all, you know, everyone who is providing information, whether it's internet-based or what have you, are compelled by the government to provide information about what U.S. citizens are doing. And if they want to continue with their government contracts, if they want to continue the subsidies they have, then they end up finding ways to provide the government with the ability, with the executive branch, this executive branch, the ability to spy on the rest of us. I mean, we have to be very, very concerned when our communications mechanisms are controlled by any small group of people, and that's what we've got now.
Mark Lloyd, our guest today on Media Matters. We've only got a couple of minutes left. Mark Lloyd, the author of the new book, Prologue to a Farce, Communication and Democracy in America, just published by University of Illinois Press. Mark, you're an old hand at media activism, and, you know, in the late 1990s, when you and I knew each other and you were working on People for Better TV, it was a pretty small community, and it really wasn't widely understood outside of relatively narrow range of people in this country what was going on. In the last 4 or 5 years, we've seen really an explosion of interest in various public policy issues around media, media ownership, public broadcasting, government propaganda. Have you been surprised by these developments, and where do you think this is going?
Well, I have not been surprised by the intelligence of the American public to understand that there is a problem there with media and that it's important for them to be engaged. I've been extraordinarily encouraged by the work that you folks at Free Press and at Common Cause and others have done to be able to pull in so many different strands of this effort into one tent and to keep it going during these pretty bleak years of the Bush administration. So I've been encouraged by that, but I've not been surprised at all that the American people understand that there's a problem and that something needs to be done about it. All the work that we did for People for Better TV suggested that people got the fact that media needed to change in the society if we were going to be able to address any of the other problems that we're concerned about, whether it's health care, education, or whether we go to war. We have to do something about media, and I mean it's wonderful to see so many people out there who get it and are pushing the right buttons to get something done.
Mark Lloyd, we've only got a few seconds left. What do you think the big issues are going to be in the next 2 or 3 years surrounding communication policy?
I think the biggest issue is we need to make sure that our presidential candidates are talking about where they stand on these issues. We need to make sure that we begin to refocus our conversation from a conversation about markets and how well the industries are doing or not doing, which industry is becoming dominant, is the internet taking over television, but instead understanding how these media, whatever they are, having an impact on our citizens' ability to understand what's going on in their local communities, to be able to express themselves, to exchange ideas, and to really have an impact and see that things they want to see changed.
On that note, Mark, I think we're running near the end of our hour here. I want to thank Mark Lloyd for being our guest on Media Matters, and I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my wonderful producer, and everyone else involved in producing the show. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll see you in 167 hours.